Today's episode is brought to you by Empower. It doesn't matter how much money you have, we all have money questions. Empower is here to answer those questions so you don't have to worry. Take control of your financial future with a real-time dashboard and real live conversations to empower what's next. Start today at empower.com.
You're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine. On this program, as you may recall, we ask poets to select a poem from the New Yorker archive to read and discuss, along with one of their own poems that's been published in the magazine. My guest today is Sophia Sinclair, whose honors include a Whiting Award, a Metcalf Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, an OCM Bocas Prize for Caribbean Poetry, and a Ruth Lilly and Dorothy Sargent Rosenberg Fellowship from the Poetry Foundation. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sophia, the poem you've decided to read for us is From the Desire Field by Natalie Diaz, which was published as part of Envelopes of Air, our online feature by Natalie Diaz and Ada Limon. It was our first interactive poetry feature at NewYorker.com. Tell us, what drew you to this particular poem as you were perusing the archives?
This poem is, to me, so magical in its imagery, in its texture, and the way she builds not just a system of imagery, but like returning to this refrain of green and desire.
Let's hear it. Here's Sophia Sinclair reading From the Desire Field by Natalie Diaz.
From the Desire Field. I don't call it sleep anymore. I'll risk losing something new instead. Like you lost your rose and moon, shook it loose. But sometimes when I get my horns in a thing, a wonder, a grief, or a line of her, it is a sticky and ruined fruit to unfasten from, despite my trembling. Let me call my anxiety desire then. Let me call it a garden. Maybe this is what Lorca meant when he said, verde que te quiero verde. Because when the shade of night comes, I am a field of it, of any worry ready to flower in my chest. My mind in the dark is una bestia, unfocused, hot, and if not yoked to exhaustion beneath the hip and plow of my lover, then I am another night wandering the desire field, bewildered in its low green glow, belling the meadow between midnight and morning. Insomnia is like spring that way, surprising and many-petaled, the kick and leap of gold grasshoppers at my brow. I am struck in the witched hours of want. I want her green life, her inside me in a green hour I can't stop. Green vein in her throat, green wing in my mouth, green thorn in my eye. I want her like a river goes bending, green, moving, fast as that, this is how it happens, soy una sonambula. And even though you said today you felt better, and it is so late in this poem, is it okay to be clear, to say, I don't feel good? To ask you to tell me a story about the sweet grass you planted and tell it again or again until I can smell its sweet smoke, leave this thrashed field and be smooth.
Well read.
Thank you.
That was From the Desire Field by Natalie Diaz from Envelopes of Air by Natalie Diaz and Ada Limon, published on NewYorker.com in May 2018. Hearing the poem, everything you said was, of course, quite accurate about it. Its music and imagery. I was struck also by its language, or should I say languages, the way it really moves effortlessly between Spanish, between high language, and I wouldn't say low language, because everything is so grand in the poem. I think that's one of its strengths. But in a very human, you know, lustful way that I think is really great. Let me call my anxiety desire then. Let me call it a garden. And then she brings up Lorca, who, you know, has been hovering over the poem, but suddenly she lets Lorca in. Tell me about, hearing it again, what comes to mind?
I do love this bodily tension in the poem, you know, and how the physical is always there and it's so reflected in the lush texture of the work, you know, that it's kind of like a vine. I imagine it as like a vine, the way that the lines sort of intertwine with each other. And we come back to this refrain of green, which is, of course, the Lorcan influence, right?
Yeah.
From his own poem.
Sleepwalking ballad.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I agree that it's so seamless the way she sort of loops in this idea of the desire to Lorca and this this refrain of green, how I want you, green.
Yeah. Which, you know, one of the great lines in poetry. And I think she manages to make it feel, and I've seen this in others of Natalie's poems, that they manage to bring in the world and other artists and other artistry and into the fabric of the poem. And I feel like that way about Spanish. It's not like Spanish is outside the poem. The poem is multilingual. The poem is announcing itself as thinking that way. And how do you read that? I mean, you read it beautifully, but how do you understand that?
I mean, it's reflecting her own world and her own body. And, you know, I think it's really done in a way that I think includes the reader, whether you are, you know what this means or not, you know. And I think that's what a good poem is supposed to do, to sort of say, this is a window into the tongues I speak, into my body, into the lyric, you know, interior of my mind. And it's something that I think Natalie Diaz does so well. And I agree that her poems really hold so much of the world in it. Sometimes it feels like it holds like all the wisdom of the universe and all the matter and dust and stars and like the trees and the thorns and the grasshoppers. It's
right,
all
right.
included in here.
And I love these. Wisdom is a good word, because she's able, I think, in this poem specifically, but in others of her poems, to say these truths. Insomnia is like spring that way, surprising and many-petaled. I mean, what a beautiful image. And it's sort of turning insomnia on its head, as it were. It's trying to make us think about insomnia. You know, I would write an insomnia poem like, this is bad, you
right.
know?
I can't sleep. Everything is terrible.
Yeah, how can I get a poem? Instead, it's like spring.
Beautiful, right?
Yeah.
And in the same way, I think that she's sort of turning this idea of anxiety on its head and say, let me call my anxiety desire then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of taking this idea of one thing and sort of completely turning it on its head through this really beautiful extended metaphor and like imagery that is to die for, really. Dream walking imagery.
Yes. And this idea of, let me call it a garden, you know, that fruitful quality that the poem is thinking about, I think is really interesting. I'm also struck by the sounds, you know. Some of what you've said, I think, is to help us understand the way that language is a bodily thing and it's embodied. And in the poem, she does that, I think, wonderfully through just visually looking at it now. You see plow and glow and brow, you know, and these words that are both, you know, full rhymes, but then also visual rhymes. And I think there's something in that that's really striking.
Yes. And to really lean into that is something that I find very pleasing in poetry, you know, to not really turn away from the formality of going towards these rhymes in the middle of the poem is so lovely. And the music of the poem, it just undulates in this way that then to me reflects this like field and garden imagery, you know,
yeah,
that she's
absolutely.
Also invoking in the poem.
There's two things I would also have us think about. One is the form of the poem, which is, as you said, has a refrain, the green that appears. And then it also has this wonderful sort of indentations that I think about that music in a way. But I was also struck by something we were talking about before, which is the refrain and the form makes me think of a ballad in a way. Though I'm also aware that these are letter poems.
Yes.
Yeah. So what about that tension?
It's an epistolary in some sense. Like the you addressed is Ada in the letter.
Right.
But it also does have the music and refrain of the ballad, of the coming back to, the longing for.
Mm-hmm. What I love about a ballad is, in the traditional sense, they start with a refrain that repeats at the end, and, you know, you've had all these things happen, and it's utterly different. It's the same words, but the experience is very different the second time around. And I feel like Green does that, sleep does that in the poem, but also this idea even of the you.
Yes.
Who is addressed, you know, the you becomes not the beloved, which is, it was, you know, like very fascinating too.
Although it could also be the beloved, you know, there in some moments where it's so tenderly rendered.
I think of it as a kind of confessor or a confessed to, but which of course is this intimacy.
Yes. I think intimate is a good word, the way that we do have these very tender confessions really about the interior life of the poet and
or the speaker.
We
always pretend,
as we say.
That they don't. Those written by someone who isn't a person.
Right.
But no, I think it's there is that little interesting gap that I think the poem is also playing with, like. I am speaking to you, and the you is the reader, the you is the listener, the you is the overhearer.
Right.
And the I kind of is this figure, the balladeer, who isn't quite the same. You know, there's a kind of risky openness that I think the balladeer commands. I am struck in the witched hours of want. I mean, geez, like, go home.
Yes, you know, like, the end.
That's like in the gospel church, you get a shoe thrown at you for singing so good, you know?
I know, and there is so much singing, right? And just right after that, you know, where she goes on this extended refrain of green, green, green. Mm-hmm. I think it reaches that like fever pitch for me in the poem. You know, I want her green life, her inside me in a green hour I cannot stop. Green vein in her throat, green wing in my mouth, green thorn in my eye. And there the punctuation goes all away.
Yeah.
You know, and to me that moment when I first read this poem, I was just like, okay, scatter my ashes, you know. I'm dead.
I love this part too, that when it says fast as that, this is how it happens. And you get the Spanish, soy una sonambula.
Mm-hmm.
My Spanish is not as good as yours. But, you know, the person is the somnambulist, a sleepwalker.
Sleepwalker.
But I think it couldn't be said any other way.
No.
You know, like there's no, and that's what makes a good poem,
right.
Of course. But well, of course you had to go away with the punctuation, of course. And these are things that I think sometimes when we're studying poetry or writing it, you're like taught not to do. Like, be consistent. Don't confuse the reader. It's like, please confuse me. After that part, I want to be overwhelmed and taken there.
I mean, in a poem, all things should be possible, really, right? In the world of the poem. And I feel that way here. You know, when we even begin with, we'll change our thinking about what sleep is and anxiety and desire. And, you know, I am the field, I am the garden, is really, I think, expanding the possibilities not only of language and body, but of what can happen.
Yeah, it's well said. I mean, I think the poem is a site of transformation.
Absolutely.
And that transforming power comes from many ways. And here it's thinking about form, thinking about other poets, a dialogue directly with another poet, but also with us. And I love that sort of give and take that a good poem provides.
Yes.
Well, speaking of good poems, in the July 2nd, 2018 issue of the magazine, The New Yorker printed your poem, Gospel of the Misunderstood, which we'll hear you read in a moment. Is there anything you want to say about it first? Anything you think listeners should know or think about before going on?
Well, I wrote this poem when I was in the, like, thicket of Floridian jungle at this place called the Atlantic Center for the Arts. And it really did feel like it was a jungle, you know. There were, you would walk through and there would just be cobwebs. You'd take them down and you'd walk through again and the cobwebs would come back, you know.
Right.
And it just seemed...
Do you like cobwebs? Is that...
No, I don't. And this was outside, you know. There was... Everything was bursting and blooming.
Yeah,
which
sure.
is very much like the landscape of Jamaica, but... This sort of then sort of crept into my mind and my body and the poem.
Okay, let's hear it.
Gospel of the Misunderstood. I want to be the blade striking knotted brown, to kiss the nape of any hunger. American beauty berry or rutted cane, warm branch of man pinning me here in mute study. To be an ache in the breast of a burst jelly is what I wanted. Vines slick and torrid in summer's greed, pressing my fears against the light of the lonely. Nameless, I haunt for God and love in extinct places, curve myself inside desire's eye and drink. All peeled vermilion, all caught promise. Again, all seeing, and finally, to be seen is what I wanted. To trawl the sleep of his body, to make a burning room of this mouth, skinned eager with spider bite and holy, split pink, drunken, choked quiet, as life unfolds its sticky wings in me, snuffing me sweetly. Isn't this love? To walk hand in hand toward the humid dark, enter the ghost web of the hungry, to consider some wants were not meant to be understood. Some women. The way my brother prays, I'll still find a man to divine me, and my father tells me lazy women will never be loved. Like today's new trumpet pushing its bright flower in my slutty way. The slow voice of its angel hissing breathless. No, he is not here. He is not here. He is nowhere.
That was Gospel of the Misunderstood.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Sophia Sinclair. I was struck hearing it again, those two parts of the poem, which we had talked about before the poem ran. I love that it's in two parts still, but... how do you see the two parts? And, you know, I know sometimes you had thought of it as one, but there seems that big leap to me. Isn't this love? Because the beginning is almost this private desire that the speaker has that then later in the poem, the brother or the father says something else about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I went back and forth between having it all be one or having the separate, because that isn't this love to me was always like a turn where the poem sort of expands or I'm sort of turning the gaze to myself. And I wondered, well, is it too obvious if I make the break here that this is a break and you know something
sure,
is turning?
Sure.
Or is this the way it should be? But then it felt natural that it should be this way.
Well, that's how you read it, I feel.
Yes.
I mean, this might be going down a little bit of inside baseball, as they say. But, you know, editing is such an important part of a poem. I know you know this, but, you know, I think sometimes people think, oh, poems just come to you.
Right.
And
I've
there they are.
It from the gods. Yes.
And this poem has that quality of organic quality in the beginning, but you can also tell it has such control, which I admire very much. That moment where you say, to be seen is what I wanted, to trawl the sleep of his body. I mean, I love just that as a line, you know. How do you compose something like that? Did it come in this way, or did you?
No, it didn't come in this way. You know, I think that I had to move some of the lines around in this, the first stanza, because I wanted this sort of accumulation of imagery and texture to reflect, you know, not only the landscape that I was living in, but also how I was feeling, you know, inside.
You managed to, I think.
And I also wanted to maintain, like, it looks good on the page. It looks sort of intentionally this way.
Mm.
And so I moved things around and took things out. You know, the maddening work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, should it be an egg or the egg?
Yeah, that's what I try to stop.
Yes.
People sometimes ask me, like, when do you know a poem's done? It's like, when I'm changing the to
you're like,
or
it's
and.
Ready.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, I'm just moving around, you know, furniture when, you know, you've built this beautiful house.
Well, I think the core of it really came, it really sort of fevered itself forward in this way. And I knew this is how I wanted it to end.
And so did you know, too, well, I mean, I love this moment where it's like today's new trumpet pushing its bright flower, great, and then in my slutty way, like this kind of judgmental quality. Did you know it would have that, or that surprise you?
Yes, I knew, because, you know, the poem is talking about desire and sort of wanting everything, to sort of hold the whole world inside, you know?
Right.
And
it's also about shame then?
Yes. In a certain kind of way.
I mean, not necessarily internal shame, but being shamed.
Being shamed, right, for particular desires, right? That sort of maybe women aren't supposed to have, or like you shouldn't articulate your desires. You should just wait. I don't know. But the line where my father sort of comes in, it actually used to be, before Lazy, I had loose women. My father tells me loose women will never be loved. And then I sort of changed that because I don't know, I felt like it was better to articulate that idea in a different way.
To I mean, that could make it more obvious,
right,
but also take it away from the subtlety that I think you're trying to capture.
Yes.
Which is judgment, but also, I don't know, something.
Ownership.
Ownership. I like that. It leads me to another question, which is, who are the misunderstood? Who be the misunderstood?
I think, for me, I wrote it in a moment where I felt misunderstood, and I felt that, like, my femininity or womanhood was misunderstood, not just by the sort of lover in the poem, but also, obviously, the other men in the sort of orbit of my life. And so it was like a moment of being misunderstood, sort of linked to different lifetimes of misunderstandings.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's my other question is it women who are the misunderstood in this poem?
Yes. I mean, I think so, absolutely. You know, I wouldn't want to speak for all women, but I definitely think that myself, I was misunderstood, and also other women who might also feel the way that I feel.
Well, it has these wonderful echoes, I think. The light of the lonely. Isn't this love? As life unfolds its sticky wings in me, snuffing me sweetly, you know? There's a lot of tension in those lines. Choked quiet. There's this kind of tension, and it's almost an allergic reaction to this giant green, as it were. But there's also this reaching for it.
Yes. Definitely reaching for, I think, all the dangerous aspects of nature, right? And I wanted to sort of explore the sort of discomforting aspects of desire, you know, and also the reflection of that in nature, that it's all, you know, it's beautiful, but also like, there's some killer spiders out, you know, like
cobwebs.
Cobwebs belonging to killer spiders out the window.
Well, I love this idea you say, which I think comes back in the end. Nameless, I haunt for God and love in extinct places. And then at the end, you have this angel who speaks. And so there is, it's a desire that's a sort of earthly desire. A nature desire, but it's also bigger than that too. It's a God hunger.
And being disappointed.
Fascinating. So tell me about that ending then. The slow voice of its angel hissing breathless.
So it was playing on this idea of, like you said, this God hunger and searching for something. In this case, something heavenly or religious or something bigger, that is then this crushing disappointment of no. You know, it's not just will the earthly corporeal desires be met, will this hunger be met, but also this other like ethereal desire, will this be met, all these answers. And then it's no. You know, he is not here. Not just a man that will divine me, but also the divine is not here.
Well, it's interesting because it's also called the gospel.
Right.
So there's a lot going on in this gospel. And I wonder how this speaks to others of the poems you're working on now. This is a newer poem?
This is new, yes.
Yeah. So tell me, you know, do you feel like you're thinking about these things? How do they compare in terms of form with this poem?
I think this was a new kind of form for me. Usually I have more breath in the poem, the way that I structure the stanzas. And I sort of let this one be a thicket of itself, you know? And I think that's something that I'm pushing towards. Like, the poem doesn't always have to be a tercet in couplets, you know? Like, you can...
What? You're messing my life
up. I know.
Because I love me a tercet and a couplet.
Yes.
So you wanted that impacted, as
I
you said, thicket.
That. Yeah.
And is that something you said you're working on now as a form in general or a voice?
Maybe more of a voice, you know? I sort of move more thematically with what, you know, what I'm working on. And this one was written in the heat of the moment, you know, as they often come. And so the poems I'm working on now are more considered and not as in passionate anger.
Well, everyone is now eager to hear what these other poems. I'm not going to get it out of you today.
I can tell you what the other poems are about.
Tell me a little bit, just a little.
Yeah,
and then
little.
I want to maybe zoom out one last question about Jamaican poetry in general.
Absolutely. I'm working on poems about sort of incorporating Rastafarian linguistics, you know, which I call Rasta poetics. Because Rasta, in Jamaica, we have like Jamaican patois, but Rastas also have their own vernacular, which I grew up with. And so I'm sort of incorporating this through a bunch of reggae songs and trying to insert a kind of womanhood in the Rasta rebellion.
This sounds powerful and exciting.
Thank you.
How's it coming? It's going well?
It's going well.
Good. And am I right? I'm not sure if I have it here, but you have a memoir?
I have a memoir coming.
A memoir?
A memoir. Yes.
So tell me briefly about the memoir.
It's called How to Say Babylon. It's, again, about my childhood growing up in Jamaica. I grew up in a very strict Rastafarian household, and I was always questioning and asking, you know, why are the rules of Rastafarianism or Rastafari different from me than they were from my brother and my father. And that was not really well received. And so, you know, there was a lot of struggle and tension between me and my father. And so I'm really exploring that relationship and my family sort of growing up as my siblings and I growing up as sort of oddities in Jamaica. I mean, Rastafarians are actually a persecuted minority in Jamaica historically, which most people don't really know. And so we were like the only Rastas in school, the only Rastas like in the supermarket. And so it was this strange kind of way to grow up, you know.
And did you have locks?
I had dreadlocks. I had all these
rules. Do you
still
have them?
Kevin, no. Some of us let them go.
I still have mine. I still have mine. That's all I'm saying.
Throw them away. Like,
I still have mine.
I find it so morbid that you still have them.
I work in archives. I love archives.
But you decided to grow them, right? It was your choice.
Sure. No, so, I'm not equating by any means my dreads grown in the 90s. But mine were long. They were long, you know.
I bet. But I didn't keep mine because, for me, cutting them was like a liberating act, you know?
Was it emotional?
Very emotional.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I mean, it was for me, and I, you know, it wasn't a religious decision.
Yeah.
And so letting go of them was part of that, I'm sure.
Yes, it was sort of part of becoming myself.
Mm-hmm. And so the book covers this.
The book covers this, yeah, covers. So, you know, I'm talking about Rastafarian culture and Jamaican history, but also my own family story in Jamaica and my relationship with my father, who's, you know, a strict reggae musician, you know, a Rasta man.
That's right.
Yeah.
The last question I had is then about when did you come in this journey to poetry, or was it always there for you?
You know, it was there for me pretty early on. And because of how I grew up, you know, I grew up in the household where I was always kind of silenced. I really turned to myself and I turned to the page. And that's really why I started writing poetry, because I found that there I could express myself and I could really cultivate not just a self, but a world that I felt at home in. And that's, you know, it started, you know, maybe 10. I started writing these poems.
That's amazing. And let me end by just thinking about Jamaican poetry, which I think of as a really rich tradition, both in general and especially right now. There's a lot of folks writing.
Yeah.
Do you think of it that way? Or do you see yourself in that pantheon of exciting Jamaican writers?
Well, I don't know if I could say I see myself in the pantheon. But, you know, I think so much exciting work is being written. And I think Jamaicans, you know, I'm biased, but we're very good at pretty much all the things that we do. So I'm very proud of my fellow, Jamaicans for what they're doing.
Right.
No, I mean, because Jamaica really holds such a broad space in the cultural global imagination.
Sure.
You know, for such a small island. In Patois, in Jamaica, we say we lickle, but we talawa. You know, it means we might be small, but we could move mountains. We could do it all.
That's right. Well said.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. It's been really a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Gospel of the Misunderstood by Sophia Sinclair, as well as Envelopes of Air by Natalie Diaz and Ada Limon, can be found on NewYorker.com. Natalie Diaz's most recent collection is When My Brother Was an Aztec. Sophia Sinclair's latest book is Cannibal. Thanks so much.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Corner by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, courtesy of Stretch Music and Rope a Dope. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Eisenman.